Let no one ever say that we here at the History of Europe podcast ignore the middle, because this week we're going all out on the middle. That vintage newsreel means it's time once again for the History of Europe podcast to begin. Welcome to the show. My name is Chris Linehan. Now that we have moved past the Paleolithic or Old Stone Age, we can focus on the Mesolithic, so then we can get to the Neolithic or the New Stone Age, where the fun really starts to happen. But before we get into the Mesolithic this week, I thought it might be a good idea to set out why these eons are differentiated in the way they are. We as human beings have been classifying ages since before history was even formally invented. Hesiod, more or less a contemporary of Homer in ancient Greece, wrote in his poem Works and Days of his intense longing for the better days of man. He said that men once lived among the gods for a long time without ever aging, but this golden age of man was not meant to last and fell into the Silver Age. During this age, men lived under the care of their mothers for about 100 years and then lived a short adult life where they fought with one another. Men in the Silver Age refused to worship the gods, and Zeus decided to zap them all for their sacrilege. After the Silver Age came and went, man entered into the Bronze Age. The Bronze Age was an age of raging hormones. These hormones expressed themselves through passionate war. All of this violence took a toll on this race of men, so much so that when they died, they went to hell. The Bronze Age came to its own violent end, a flood. After the Bronze Age flood, man ascended into the Heroic Age. This was the only age in which Hesiod reported that men had improved upon the preceding age. It was during the Heroic Age that the Trojan War was fought by men and the sons of God who dwelt among them. But the Heroic Age came to a close, and Hesiod found himself living smack dab in the middle of the Iron Age. The Iron Age, he said, was dismal, consisting of human toil and miserable suffering. There was not the passion of the Bronze Age or the courage or valor of the Heroic Age. Men desired only power, and power only sustained them. Hesiod predicted that this current age would end when babies were born with gray hair, and the gods finally decided to abandon mankind for good. Fairly depressing stuff. A couple of Romans, however, presented their own age description some 600 years or so after Hesiod. Lucretius stated that rather than things getting worse like they did in Hesiod's view, things were getting better. Lucretius states that men used to use their hands, nails, and teeth to fight. Then they used trees and rocks. Then they discovered fire. With fire they learned to smelt copper. After copper, iron came and caused copper to fall into disrepute. Lucretius thought that the men of the pre-iron eras were tougher than his contemporaries, but were more like beasts and not as sophisticated as his age of man. The other Roman, an admirer of Lucretius, set out his own cosmological ages. And while Ovid admired the work of Lucretius, he followed Hesiod more in that his ages showed the slow degradation of man. First, there was the Golden Age, when man lived in a world governed by sound justice and perpetual peace. Then came the Silver Age, where man learned agriculture and architecture. Third came the Bronze Age, when men liked to fight and go to battle, but were not impious. Like Hesiod, though, Ovid lived in the Iron Age, where men drew boundary lines for countries, mined the earth greedily, and fought each other to move those lines and to take what was being mined. The mythological understandings of the origins of culture in Europe were still widely held throughout much of Europe's history, but some changes in how we understand these periods started to arise in the 16th century with Michel Mercati. Mercati was an important church official who started to observe black stone objects found throughout Europe. He thought they looked like axes and arrowheads, not thunderstones created by lightning as the prevailing thought of the day was. He asked himself, why would anyone make things out of stone rather than metal? Eureka! Obviously, metallurgy had yet to be invented. He died, but his work was published after his death and helped to prod further investigations into the matters of these thunderstones. A three-age system was proposed sometime in the 17th century, and scientists and thinkers continued to tinker with it. Then in the 19th century, a Danish museum curator, Christian Jurgensen Thomsen, turned the whole thing into a chronologically based scheme. Sir John Lubbock, a British baron, took Thompson's work, as well as some others, and created a cultural anthropology view of the whole thing, devising four distinct periods. 1, the Paleolithic. 2, the Neolithic, which he described as the more polished Stone Age. 3, the Bronze Age. And 4, the Iron Age. Ernst Haeckel, a German, borrowed from Sir John Lubbock and coined the term Mesolithic or Middle Stone Age toward the end of the 19th century in a series of lectures. More borrowing, stealing, and adapting of the classification systems occurred and divided them, and further subdivided these ages. This has continued right up until this very day. As some evidence is found, the paradigm moves a bit to accommodate the new data. Sometimes it pushes out old data, other times it complements or confirms it. For the purpose of this podcast, we're going to use the three terms Paleolithic, Mesolithic, and Neolithic. I don't want to get bogged down in the Epipaleolithic, Late Paleolithic, Early Neolithic, Pre-Farming Neolithic, or any other fancy subdivisions of the Three Stone Age system because it's confusing and twisted and hard to follow through listening. What I'm going to propose then is a simple division into the three eras. So when we say the Paleolithic, what we're talking about is early human development from about 2.6 million years ago through the end of the Pleistocene epoch, around 10,000 years ago. When we talk about the Mesolithic, we're talking about the Holocene epoch, which began roughly 10,000 BC through around 5,000 BC when farming began to become a staple in Europe. When we talk about the Neolithic next time, we're referring to the Neolithic Revolution when man learned to farm and make pottery, but hadn't yet learned to use metal. After that, we'll get into the Chalcolithic that begins around 3500 BC. The dates of these three Stone Age periods overlap one another and are different geographically. The reason for this is that people switched from eras based on the technology they had, not because of some calendar event. The Paleolithic is pretty easy to define. It goes way back until the world started getting warmer. The Holocene, a geological epoch we're still living in today, is way warmer than the Pleistocene and created more hospitable conditions for mankind. Man's culture changed along with this weather, but it changed gradually, not dramatically or instantly. This slow change is the Mesolithic period we'll discuss today. The next changes are huge and dramatic, with the introduction of farming and pottery signaling the start of the Neolithic. Both the Paleolithic and Neolithic are much easier to define, which leaves us stuck today with the murky and downright elusive Mesolithic Age. The Mesolithic couldn't have happened without the aid of the Holocene. The Holocene was a time when things started to perk up in the weather a bit. Technically speaking, the Holocene is a geological epoch that is an interglacial era of the current Ice Age. What that means for us in this show is that things got warmer, different, animal patterns changed, some went extinct, and areas that were once blocked off from human populations became populatable. So we'll divide this podcast into regional chronologies today. The Paleolithic and Mesolithic weren't sharply different, and cultures generally evolved slowly in this period to adapt to changes in the weather. A big group of hunters called the Hamburg culture followed reindeer all over Europe, including France, Poland, Germany, and Scandinavia towards the end of the Paleolithic period. The Hamburg culture generally and gradually split apart, and new cultures began to arise out of them. The Hamburg culture wasn't the only one that did this, though. Last time we talked about the Isilian culture in France. It did the same thing that the Hamburg culture did, only on a more localized scale. Also, these cultures weren't developing in complete isolation. There was some cultural exchange between groups, and this in turn led to the development of other cultures. It was this slow merging and splintering that formed many cultures that we'll talk about here today. Let's start in Northern Europe. Why? Well, because the Paleolithic was so damn cold most of the time, Northern Europe didn't get as much love in the last podcast. So we'll start there today. The Khamsa culture existed around 10,000 BC in northern Norway. It's likely that it broke off from the more general Arnsberg culture, who we'll talk about in a bit. It appears, though, that these hunters started settling along the coast of Norway and made it all the way north to the Finnmark region, where they were given the name of Khamsa after a mountain that stands there. In addition to the tools and weapons that are likely to be found among these types of people, evidence of boats show early ambitions to look to the sea for food. It is also likely that these guys hunted seals. The Magalmosian culture lasted from about 9500 BC through 6000 BC. These guys were found in various parts of Northern Europe, Denmark, Poland, Sweden, France, and even England. Rather than settling along the coast like the Khomsa, the Magomosian cultures were found living on edges of forests nearby rivers, marshes, and wetlands. But these were not permanent settlements, as the Magomosian were most definitely nomadic in nature. They hunted using wood, bone, and flint microliths that were pretty sophisticated for the era. They also may have been pioneers in using domesticated dogs during hunting. When they weren't out hunting the various types of reindeer that populated Northern Europe at the time, they were fishing with a personal development of theirs, the leister, or trident fishing spear. The Magomosians would develop into a number of different cultures. In Scandinavia, their cultural legacy would be taken up by the Kongomos culture, but we have to talk about some of the Magomosian northerly neighbors for a moment first. The Fosna-Hensbacka culture were contemporaneous with the Magomosian and flourished from around 8300 BC through 7300 BC. This is one culture living in two areas, thus they get a hyphenated name because of archaeological realpolitik. The Fosna were centered in Norway, and the Hensbacka were located in Sweden. Both sets of the culture seemed to have developed from the aforementioned Arnsberg culture as they headed further and further north. These guys were like their Norwegian neighbors and settled along the sea. Like the early Akomsa culture, they used boats, probably for fishing and seal hunting, but it could have been for leisurely sailing games as well. Who knows? The Kongomos culture sprang up from the Magomosians, who decided to stick it out in Denmark rather than go back to Germany with the rest of the groups. They occupied Zealand, now an island off of Denmark's east coast, and lasted from around 6000 BC through 5200 BC. Whilst there, they created some characteristic geometric microliths. For some reason, the Kongomos were obsessed with rhombuses or rhombi, not really sure which it is, and spell check is allowing them both. They created rhombic-shaped arrowheads, rhombic-shaped scrapers, rhombic-shaped drills, and rhombic-shaped awls. They used these tools to hunt red deer, roe deer, wild boar, and to spearfish. The Kongomos would eventually become permanent fixtures on the landscape and evolve into or be taken over by the Ertebolic culture. The Nostfet and Lihult cultures were a lot like their forebears, the Fosna-Hensbacka culture. The Nostfet being Norwegian and the Lihult being Swedish. The artifacts and the way of living appear to be so similar that we can group these two groups together. They seem to have subsisted on fishing and hunting marine animals and lasted from around 6200 BC to 3200 BC. This brings us to the end of the Mesolithic Northern Europe and Scandinavia, so we'll move on east into the northeast of Europe. The first culture we'll mention is the Swedarian culture that lasted from about 8500 BC through 7600 BC. The Swedarians seem to have invaded Poland sometime towards the end of the Pleistocene and could have possibly come from the Arnsberg culture. The reason that most people think that this culture was not native to Poland is because of the flint tools that are associated with them. They are poorly constructed in comparison to their contemporaries elsewhere in Europe. But people don't think that this is because there was anything innately wrong with Swedarian craftsmanship. Rather, they see that the flint they're using was not the best in the area. The Swedarians appear to have followed some animals, probably reindeer in Poland, set up a base camp and used the rocks of flint they found there, rather than the better flint in the area. Regardless of the origin, the Swedarian culture is one of the earliest Mesolithic cultures in this area. The Kunda culture is rooted in the Swedarian culture. They thrived in the Baltic Forest Zone, Latvia, and northern Russia from around 8000 BC to 5000 BC. However, the oldest settlement that shows signs of Kunda culture is the Puli settlement along the Pärnu River in Estonia, dating back nearly 11,000 years ago. The Kunda culture was a hunter-gatherers, but they created semi-permanent settlements along the edges of forests near rivers, lakes, and marshes. They developed some innovative hunting techniques, employing advanced technology and bone and antler tools. They also used domesticated dogs in hunting. The Niemen culture is another culture that dominated this area during the Mesolithic, occupying parts of northern Poland, Lithuania, Belarus, and the Kaliningrad Oblast. The Niemen culture is also one of the longest-lived Mesolithic cultures, lasting from 6000 BC to 2000 BC. Like the Klunda culture, the Neiman culture was rooted in the previous culture and marks a general evolution and continuation of Swindarian culture. The Neiman culture was a hunter group that used bow and arrows and spears and harpoons to fish with. As the Neiman culture became more sophisticated, they began to live a more sedentary lifestyle and eventually evolved into a Neolithic culture with the advent of farming and pottery. Before we move on, I'd like to mention one last thing, the Shigir idol. The Shigir idol is the most ancient wooden sculpture in the world, dating from around 7500 BC. It was found near the Ural Mountains in Russia in 1894. It's currently on display at a museum in Yekaterinburg, Russia. The sculpture depicts a human body that is a little more than 9 feet tall. The face appears pretty lifelike, but the body is flat and skinny with geometric shapes carved into it. There's no consensus on what exactly the statue was depicted for. I'll go out on a limb and say it was an early coat and hat rack. You can see a picture of the Shigir idol and a little blurb on the podcast website, thehistoryofeuropepodcast.blogspot.com. Let's go ahead and move on into southeastern Europe and talk about Albania, Croatia, Serbia, Macedonia, mainland Greece, Bosnia, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria, and Moldova. Southeastern Europe is sometimes said to not have a Mesolithic period because there wasn't the slow drift from Paleolithic to Neolithic like we saw in northern Europe. There wasn't as great a change due to climate changes in human populations. Since climate played such a major part in the animal patterns in the north, and cultures developed to adapt to these changing patterns, you don't get it as much in southeastern Europe. But some of the earliest modern human remains come from this region in Romania, so we have to at least talk about it somewhat. The Peshtur Cuas in Romania had human remains in it dating well into the Paleolithic some 40,000 years ago. And it would appear that these early Cro-Magnon men liked to live in the caves for a long time thereafter. The culture seems to have just settled throughout the Pleistocene, and then boom, the Neolithic Revolution happened, and farming became big. Thus, the Mesolithic is really hard to define in this area, but we'll do with our best. We'll do our best with a couple quick notes. In Romania, Transylvania, and Moldova, there appears to have been elements of the Tardenoisian culture. The Tardenoisian culture was mostly centered in France and Belgium, so we'll talk about them here shortly. But suffice it to say that this culture was semi-nomadic hunter-gatherers that liked to use flint tools. The main Mesolithic culture of southeastern Europe we'll talk about today is the Lipensky-Vir culture. Lipensky-Vir was centered in Serbia and survived from around 7000 BC through 4800 BC. The Lipensky-Vir culture was very different than many of its European contemporaries. They are likely descendants of a hunter-gatherer group based in Czech Republic. For some reason, they tired of the nomadic life and decided to settle on the banks of the Danube. They built fishing communities and well-planned villages, and in these villages were settled homes rather than the semi-permanent ones of much of the rest of Mesolithic Europe. The Lipensky-Vir culture developed around rivers in more ways than just planning and building villages. They produced a plethora of sculptures indicating a rich social and religious life. Many of the sculptures were of fish-like creatures, suggesting an early association with river gods. Let's go ahead now and move south into the Mediterranean region. The Mediterranean is an interesting and different place compared to the northern parts of Europe. Like southeastern Europe, it had been inhabited for a long time, deep into the Paleolithic, and had a relatively short Mesolithic period. We'll hit two quick topics today and move on. In the future podcast, we'll spend an enormous time on this region, so I don't feel too bad leaving it a little short today. First, there's the matter of the Franciscan Cave, which I'm sure that I just butchered in saying. The cave is located on the Peloponnese and was used by humans as early as 20,000 years ago. It was chock full of interesting artifacts, and it is noted as the oldest agricultural site in Greece. In the cave, they found evidence of hunter-gatherers, but also evidence of almond, pistachios, and lentils, wild oats, and wild barley dating from around 10,500 BC through 7300 BC. They also found artifacts from Asia Minor and the island of Melos, indicating early trade along these islands. There's also evidence of deep-sea fishing materials showing man's capability to fish in the open waters at a very early date. The islands off Greece were also beginning to be settled in the Mesolithic Age. A number of islands show evidence of human settlement dating back to as early as 9000 BC. Many of these settlements appear to have come from the Levant and Asia Minor, In an interesting twist, the Greeks and precursor to the Greeks will eventually go back and colonize both of these areas that originally populated them. Now we'll move on to Western and Central Europe, where we have a couple cultures to talk about that we've mentioned tangentially already. First, we'll talk about the Azilian culture. The Azilian culture was a late Paleolithic, early Mesolithic culture that really sums up the haziness between these two periods, and the reason why many archaeologists and anthropologists like to use the term Epipaleolithic. Epipaleolithic simply means a period of the Paleolithic that is merging with the technological age known as the Mesolithic. In other words, the cultures are both Paleolithic and Mesolithic, and neither simultaneously. So without further confusing jargon, let's talk about the Azilian culture. The Azilian culture covered a period of 10,000 BC to 8,000 BC and was mostly located in France. Interestingly, the Azilian culture actually suffered a decline in cultural variety from the preceding Paleolithic culture called the Magdalenian. This is probably because of the rapidly warming climate and the changes that made it difficult for the Azilians to respond, so they had less time for ornate cultural frills. While their cultural inspiration declined, their technology did not. The Azilian culture was at the forefront of the increasing microlith technology movement. Eventually, the Azilian culture would branch off and spawn a number of cultures and evolve into and meld with the Tardanoisian culture. Before we get to that, though, let's talk about our friends in the Arnsberg culture. We've mentioned them before as they were responsible for a number of offshoots in Northern Europe and Scandinavia. Remember that the Komsa and Fosna-Hensbacher cultures developed out of the Arnsberg culture, and thus so did the Nostfet and Lihult cultures by way of the Fosna-Hensbacher in Scandinavia. The Arnsberg culture also gave birth to the Swiderian in Poland, and then the Swiderians birthed the Kunda and Niemann cultures. All things considered, the Arnsberg culture had an enormous impact on the development of Mesolithic Europe. So who were these prolific producers of progeny? They were, wait for the big surprise, nomadic hunter-gatherers. Specifically, they hunted big game, much like the Paleolithic cultures we talked about last week. They focused primarily on reindeer and mammoth. When the mammoth went extinct, they took up fishing. Beyond spawning a number of subsequent cultures, though, the Arnsberg culture is best remembered because they possess the earliest evidence of bow hunting in Europe. This is probably what allowed them to be so successful in so many different parts of Europe. The Swabterian culture is another culture in Western and Central Europe that tried its hand at moving north when the weather warmed. They would eventually give rise to the earliest Nordic culture, one we mentioned a few minutes ago called the Maglemosian culture. But before they moved up, they made some changes to microlith technology that had changed the game. Sometime in their history of roughly 8,000 to 7,000 BC, they tired of producing laminar and non-geometric microliths, and developed the first geometric microlith. This meant basically that their blades became better suited for hunting. The creation of geometric microliths allowed for tools to become increasingly useful and diverse. As stated before, the Swabterian culture migrated north and became the Maglemosian culture, and subsequently the Congomos. But not all of them migrated. Some of them stayed put in France and Belgium, where they merged with the Azilian elements to become the Tardanoisian culture. The Tardanoisian culture pops up on the scene somewhere around 7500 BC and lasts through to become a Neolithic culture. They were centered in France and Belgium, but obviously their culture spread beyond that localized region because traces of the Tardanoisian culture show up as far east as Moldova and Romania. They perfected microlith technology and used a new advanced way to make them known as the pressure technique. This technique allowed them to make more accurate cuts on the stone to create even better tools. The last culture we'll mention for this region is the Swifterband culture. The Swifterband culture could have been mentioned earlier in the section on Northern Europe and Scandinavia because it was centered in the Netherlands around 5300 to 3400 BC. In addition to being geographically close to Northern Germany and thus cultures that lived there and eventually moved into Denmark regions, it was culturally similar to these northern cultures. Again, we have likely some sort of Arnsberg connection. The Swifterband culture is also closely akin to the Erdeboll culture, a Scandinavian culture that comes out of the Congomos and drags the region into the Neolithic. The Swifterbands, though, settled in Holland along the water. thus we're putting them in the Central Western European section. They are a transitional culture, seeing humans develop from hunter-gatherers to herdsmen and farmers. But we'll have more to say about this in the Neolithic podcasts. Lastly, let's go ahead and talk about the British Isles and their culture in the Mesolithic. The development of Britain during the Mesolithic matched much of the continent, in that it was a gradual shift from the Paleolithic to the Neolithic. However, the climate warming drastically changed things in Britain, first to cut off the island from the rest of Europe as water levels rose. Then the animal population changed, meaning Neolithic Britons had to adapt their hunting styles. They did this and became particularly adept at hunting the population of elk, boar, deer, and the mighty aurochs, that food would eventually become scarce. The Neolithic revolution of farming happened in Britain out of necessity, as men had hunted the prey to dangerously low levels. But we'll focus on that the next time. So let's go ahead and talk a little bit about the interesting find on these islands. Starkar is the oldest structure in Britain, dating from around 8770 BC through 8460 BC. The place has produced a number of artifacts, like barbed blades that made it harder for prey to get away, worked bone and antler tools, and things made from amber and wood. There is evidence of post holes that indicate some sort of structure that may have been like a wigwam. Contemporary finds in Cremond show the earliest human settlement in Scotland, dating to around 8500 BC. There they found some microliths that predate any other English ones similar to that style. They also found discarded hazelnut shells, indicating that the hunter-gatherers of Cremond enjoyed Nutella sandwiches. And who doesn't? Aveline's Hole is located in Somerset, England, and held some human bone fragments dating from around 8400 BC to 8200 BC. Inside the hole were crosses inscribed on the walls that are similar to others in contemporary sites in France, Germany, and Denmark, suggesting some of the origins of these Mesolithic Britons. Howick House is another Mesolithic structure in England that gives insights into Mesolithic England. The house was located in Northumberland and dates to around 7600 BC. Inside the house, a number of nut-roasting hearths, furthering my theory on Mesolithic Britons being into Nutella. In Somerset, near Cheddar Gorge, archaeologists uncovered Britain's oldest full skeletal remains of a human and named him Cheddar Man. Cheddar Man has a giant hole in his skull suggesting a violent end, but this isn't completely conclusive. What is conclusive, though, is that DNA testing that they did on Cheddar Man showed that he had two exact mitochondrial DNA matches and one match with a single mutation living in Cheddar Village in 1997. This means that these matches and Cheddar Man share an ancestor from thousands of years ago on their mom's side. Pretty cool stuff that we can do today. The last site we'll talk about this week is Mount Sandal, located in County Londonderry, Northern Ireland. Mount Sandal is the oldest archaeological site in Ireland, dating back to around 7000 BC. It seems to have been a popular place throughout the ages, though, because an Iron Age fort was built next door, and that was used by Jean de Courcy in the 12th century as a home as he conquered vast swaths of Ireland and ended the independence of the Ulaid, which in English is Ulster, the province of Ireland, where Mount Sandal is now located. So on that note, I'll go ahead and wrap things up. Join us next time when we discuss the Neolithic Revolution and the Neolithic Age, which is a little bit easier to define than a Mesolithic. So if you're bored this week and you just cannot wait for the next podcast, go ahead and go check us out at thehistoryofeuropepodcast.blogspot.com. to see updates and some other neat, fascinating things of this era. Also, go ahead and leave me a comment or two and let me know where I'm messing up or what you'd like to learn more about. Thanks and have a good day. See you next week.